our guest today is Muntasir Sattar, who is a volunteer for South Asian Youth Action in New York City. And Muntasir has been immersed in the South Asian American community for several years now. And not only has he been volunteering in nonprofits related to South Asian Americans, but also doing his PhD work in around the issues in this particular community. And we'll let him talk to that a little more as we progress. So, hi, Muntasir.
Hello.
And, of course, we have my partner here, Bill Cameron. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Yusuf. Hey, Muntasir.
So we want to get started today. When Bill and I were talking about having you as a guest, Muntasir, there are so many topics that came to mind, so many rich topics around the South Asian community and what the superficial perception is and what the reality is and really what the diversity within the community is in terms of how South Asians live in North America. And SIA is a reflection of that particular diversity that we were talking about. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved with South Asian Youth Action?
Sure. I was a student finishing up my master's at a college in Manhattan, and someone asked me to teach English on the weekends. So there was an organization that I heard about, and when I inquired, they told me that they needed someone they needed as many tutors as they could get because they had a number of students, mostly high school. And I said I was somewhat interested, and one day I found myself on a mass email with my name on a tutoring schedule on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. So that's how I got started.
And Muntasir, what does SIA do?
SIA is really the only organization of its kind in the United States that's a non-sectarian community organization devoted to providing opportunities and resources for South Asian youth. And basically it's technically, in terms of the tax and the paperwork, it's a 501c3. And it's a combination of a youth development institution and a social organization at the same time. So it's not just your Boys and Girls Club kind of an institution, but it's not just your social organization, but it's kind of a hybrid.
Hey, Muntasir, it's Bill. Tell us a little bit about the young people that participate in SIA. Are they pretty diverse in terms of their backgrounds? Would you describe part of the offering of being with at-risk youth? Tell us a little bit about these young people.
Sure. Well, the setting is quite important, and that is Queens. Queens is a pretty big borough. It's not the biggest borough in New York City, but it's got some of the most diverse, communities in terms of language, culture, social background, and it's got a very large percentage of immigrants. And in some sense, how it plays out in reality is that the landscape of Queens is built in a way that's really good for the grid. It's a great grid. And unfortunately, what that means is there are not a lot of open spaces and there are not a lot of social spaces, and it's not easy to congregate. So what ends up happening is that youth don't have all that much stuff to do. And after school, they don't necessarily want to be at home, and they don't want to stay in. They don't necessarily want to hang around school either. So what ends up happening is that a lot of youth are from the youth. Some of our youth are from all backgrounds. You have all races and almost all nationalities represented in relative to Queens, of course. So that means that there are students who are recent immigrants from Bangladesh or Nepal or Tibet, and there are some students who are born and raised in Queens, and some that are third generation Pakistani, Indian, or Bangladeshi American.
I know Bill and I were talking about this earlier. Before I was exposed to SIA, I had this monolithic view of the South Asian community, which is very prosperous, you know, one of the most prosperous immigrant communities, I guess the most prosperous immigrant communities in the United States right now in terms of per capita income, education, what have you. And when I came across SIAE, I was surprised to see this particular part of the demographic of South Asians and how, you know, they're overlooked to a large extent. And Bill was saying something similar living in the South. Bill, what was your reaction to hearing about SIAE?
Yeah, you know, I live in the South. I live in Charlotte, although I'm from the greater New York area originally. You know, I think the word monolithic that you used, Yusuf, is exactly the right one. I think that there's a general tendency to see the South Asian community as uniformly affluent and educated and prosperous. And it sounds like there's a much more nuanced and textured picture out there. And candidly, it's not one that I've got a lot of exposure to. I mean, certainly would be glad to learn more about it. So, Muntasir, when we're talking about these young people, give us a little description of some of the different examples that there are. Kids who just arrived from South Asia, some who are born in the U.S., multi-generation. Help us understand a little bit about what the greater New York area and SIAE has in terms of youth experience.
Okay, sure. It's the answer is kind of linked to the economy and it's kind of linked to immigration policy. So after 1965, after immigration reform, you had, you can say, get the cream of the crop from the subcontinent and from other countries coming. And so you had young people come here for education, for advanced degrees, and they stayed on and they started businesses. But then as the immigration controls changed and as policies changed, as the economy changed, the United States really needed more and more laborers, more farmers, more individuals who could fulfill roles plug holes in the economy. And so what ended up happening in New York is a number of individuals who came through the agricultural policies. Their visas given to farmers and to others from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and other countries on agricultural visas. And what ended up happening, not all of them went to the farms. And what ended up happening was a number of them concentrated in New York City. You can say that they congregated in Jackson Heights and certain parts of Queens and New York City. And what we have today is to some degree cyclical migration. And you also have new immigrants being unified under family reunification visas and policy. So the result at a youth organization such as SIAE is that we have students who have been here for you know, two generations or more, and those who are very, very new. And so we have students from all different countries. We have students speaking various different dialects and languages, Tibetan and various dialects of Tibetan and Nepali. And you also have the undocumented laborers who fill a major, very important role in New York City in the United States, and their children. And their children, of course, are barred from many opportunities. They can't get scholarships to university. They cannot get jobs. And of course, what we have basically forming is a major divide of haves and have-nots in terms of our community. New York City, and I'm not saying all of New York City's South Asian community is undocumented, but there's a pretty large minority that is. And regardless of citizenship status, regardless of legal status, I mean, you have a number of laborers who fill an important role in New York City's economy, in the restaurants, in transportation, and their children are you know, quite often, not always, but fairly often, the first in their families to go to college. Some families are illiterate, and so the students are the first in their families to read and write. So you have a diversity of those whose families do own property and do have land, do own apartments or houses, and you have those who are on public welfare or food stamps. So it's a nice big collection of young people.
So I see the connection now to immigration policy and immigration status in general. So what happens to these young men and women? Suppose SIA helps them get into college, and they're the first in their family to get to college. But if they don't have immigration status, what happens after they graduate?
That's a big problem. That's a very big problem. Some of them have been some of them, not my students necessarily, but students who I know and who I've met or who are friends or associates have been deported. And so I've met some youth in Pakistan, in Karachi, for example, who were in the United States for a long time, and they, after September 11th, the climate economically and politically was just too much to bear, and so they left. Those who do stay on have trouble, so they work in the informal sector, which is basically they work for cash and totally off the books. And of course, the authorities, everyone knows about this, but you know, no one wants to bother to change the policies. It's quite convenient economically because you get free cheap labor. So very educated, very smart young people are a source of almost free labor, and they can be treated any way they want, any way employers want. Some of them have married, and so they get citizenship that way. Of course, that's another open secret. And so there's a number of different pathways, and it kind of depends on who they know, their support network, and their own dreams and their own aspirations.
Yeah. Hey, Muntas here. It's Bill. I as you were speaking, I have my mind wandered across a few different topics as I was listening, and you mentioned dreams, and I actually thought that was kind of interesting because, you know, the American dream, you don't necessarily need to elaborate what it is. I think everyone has a general idea that it has something to do with living better than your parents did in certain ways, materially, in terms of degree of freedom, et cetera. Do these people see the American dream in the same way that maybe their parents did or a couple generations ago people coming from South Asia did? Or is there a difference? Tell me a little bit about how these young people would look at the larger culture and the prospect of the American dream.
Wow, that's a great question. I think that they do still have that notion. They still have that young people still have the notion that they can succeed and they can make it. And even though, politically or economically things are not as good as they used to be, they can still succeed. And relatively speaking, compared to their positions, back in their parents' home countries, maybe they're even better off here, regardless of their legal status. They do have dreams, and while a lot of young people do realize that the economy isn't as strong as it used to be there, that they still have a place, in society and the economy, and they see themselves as American. The vast majority, I think, do see themselves as a part of society, in spite of how society treats or sees them.
So, Muntas, given their circumstances, and some of them are in precarious circumstances, some of them actually do live a better life than their previous generation. So what are the ideas, some of the themes or ideas that SIA provides that's really helpful to these young men and women in terms of support?
Oh, that's another great question. I was hoping you'd ask that. Well, what organizations like SIA and SIA, of course, itself, it offers mentorship. I think that's a great role that needs to be played because parents are so busy working. If they do have parents, or if they have both parents, or if they have their whole families, because not all families are here together. I mean, some are here with a father or a mother, and someone else is left back home because of immigration policy or whatever. So
mentorship. So the idea with mentorship, I'm assuming, mm-hmm. is, hey, here's somebody that's been through the system, that understands the system, somewhat succeeded in this system, and yeah. This person, this man or woman, will guide you as to how the system works and how you can be successful in it. Is that what the idea is behind the mentor program at SIA?
Yeah, that is definitely part of the idea. The other idea is also to build relationships and to build trust. And so sometimes young people don't necessarily have role models in the United States. The media, of course, doesn't present very positive role models, in my opinion, let alone, you know, Asian or minority role models or models of color. So when mentorship at an organization like SIA is basically very important for young people to see an example of success, an example of a pathway or alternative pathways that they might pursue in their careers. So that's another dimension. That's another part of thinking behind mentorship. The other thing that SIA does really well is to provide a social space, a gym, free facilities, and pretty good facilities too. Not just anything, but pretty good computer access, pretty good athletic facilities, very good academic resources and opportunities, internships. So an organization such as SIA plays, I think, a major role in shaping their careers and their academic pathways.
Talking about social space, Bill, when I visited SIA, one of the staples, one of the, I would say, flagship programs there is the basketball program. And through that basketball program, I've seen so many young South Asian men, young men mentored informally on the basketball court. So although they're playing basketball and that's what they're there for because that's fun, you have mentors there playing with them, coaching them, and in so many ways. And Muntasir, actually, a few summers ago, I was a part of this program, and I saw him very artfully, without imposing himself, really provide the space, as he says, to these young men through basketball. Muntasir, can you talk to me a little bit more about that basketball program? Because I know that model. Mm-hmm. When I was at the SIA fundraiser last year, I know that model has been replicated in Michigan, in the Bangladeshi community with the youth there.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell me about this connection between basketball and mentoring? What's going on here?
Oh, wow. It's a hard one. I don't know how to explain that. It's basically, in my eyes, I think it's no fun for a young person just to be at school or to be at home all day or to go to the mall. I think there's got to be something else fun. I think athletics, I think basketball is a good and cheap way to do something, to challenge yourself, to have a bit of fun, and also to build a bridge with some adults. You know, I think that young people really love that tension from adults, and they like to get to know people who are older and have maybe traveled in the same shoes or in the same kinds of dealing with the same issues they did. So
I think there's a connection between the actual sport that's chosen in this context. So, for example, as opposed to indoor soccer, where I know it's in Bangladesh is really popular, and some of the other in Nepal it's really popular, or as opposed to cricket, which is really the second most popular game in the world, and South Asia is a hub of cricket, they chose basketball. That's what they gravitate toward. And I think there's something inherently American about basketball. And these young men expressing themselves through basketball is a representation of the part of them that is American.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. Some young men who have grown up here, or even who haven't, they're not interested in cricket. They're interested in basketball. It's just what's played in Queens. It's the most popular sport in New York City, I think.
Yeah.
And that just goes to show, you know, their sense of self as New Yorkers.
Yeah.
Hey, Muntasir, it's Bill. So a question.
Yeah.
I'm sure that the right answer is that there's a different perspective for every single individual, right, involved in SIA. So I'm going to betray my question as perhaps being a little simplistic, but I'll ask it anyway. How do these young men and women see South Asia? They're seeing it through an American lens. They're seeing it at a distance, both geographically and culturally. But they may go home and hear Urdu or Nepali spoken. They may eat food that's, you know, incongruous with a larger culture around them. So talk a little bit about cultural identity and how that figures into what we're talking about.
Cultural identity. That's complicated because they have so many influences, you know. And of course, in Queens, there's a major, very, very big Hispanic population. There's a big African American population, many Asians. So the influences are pretty heterogeneous. In terms of cultural identity, I think they see themselves as part of a faith community, as part of a linguistic community. So it's a complicated one. I think it's really a whole hodgepodge. That's what makes Queens Queens, you know. That's what's special about the borough.
Great.
I also wanted to. I'm very curious about this, and I don't know how talked about this particular question is, but it's just in my mind, and in the spirit of openness, I want to ask this question. A big part of the board of SIA and the a lot of the volunteers and officers in SIA and people who work there and help out, they're actually Indian, of Indian descent. And a lot of the population that's served, Indians don't represent a lot of the population that's served. And so what's behind that in terms of just sheer demographics? Why aren't there more Indian kids of Indian descent who are served at SIA?
There are a lot of Indians served. I think if you think about it demographically, maybe a quarter of our youth are African American. Another quarter are probably North Indian, Punjabi mainly. Elmhurst, that's because that's how Elmhurst really is and Queens really is. And then another major population at the organization is also Bangladeshi. In terms of faith that goes across, that's largely Sikh, Christian, and Muslim, and those are probably the three biggest groups I would say. In terms of what was the question about the mismatch or about?
Well, yeah. So it didn't seem like there were as many a youth from the Indian community, and I was wondering if it's because the Indian community is doing a good job through faith-based organizations like temples, et cetera, to provide the support that's needed for the kids in that community. Is that true? Is that one of the reasons why Indian Hindu kids aren't as represented in terms of the population that serves at SIA?
That's a good indication, I think, that some communities are much more organized than others. The Hindu Center in Flushing has its own SAT programs and musical programs. It has a fantastic set of services for young people. And the Jain Temple in Elmhurst also has its own set of programs and opportunities for young people. So they're fantastic. In spite of that, we still have a lot of Hindus and a lot of Jains. And now in terms of the makeup, it's hard to say, you know, it's because we have so many youth and there are so many young people from different backgrounds. Do Indian institutions do a better job of serving youth? I'm not sure about that. I really can't say. But I do know that some institutions are much more organized than others.
Yeah, makes sense. I know, Montessori, that you've outside of SIA, you've done, you're working on your thesis and your doctorate work around the South Asian community in Brooklyn. And did one thing lead to another? Did your work at SIA influence your thesis topic? How did that work?
Yes, I influenced my thesis topic way too much, actually, and that's kind of what led me to neglect my role as a researcher and as a graduate student. And initially, I was really excited about going to Brooklyn and I thought I would see the same things in Brooklyn as I saw in Queens, but I didn't. I thought that I'd see youth organizations. I thought I'd see very organized religious communities. I thought I'd see. I thought I'd see. I really thought I'd see one community, one Pakistani community, but that's not what I saw, and that kind of caught me off guard, because Brooklyn is, I think, quite different from Queens. Did Psy influence my research questions and my theoretical orientation? Yeah, in terms of what I expected, I thought I would do a sort of a needs assessment, a youth study, but those questions, I realized after spending some time in Brooklyn that there are some prior and some more basic things that need to be understood and explained first before jumping into questions about youth and services and youth development.
What are some of those basic questions, Muntasar?
There's a couple of things. One of the things I began to realize was how important the relationship with the city. I started to see how, and before I could think about youth programs, I need to think about youth. I need to think about the relationships between young people, between the leaders of the community, and between agencies of the city, the police department, HRA, Human Resources Administration, the Department of Education. I began to see there's a number of different linkages, political, or driven around administration of policy that really affect the community. So I began to rethink my understanding of South Asians in the United States. I began to see what I didn't see in Queens as strongly as I saw in Brooklyn was a much stronger partnership between Pakistanis and between the DA, the Brooklyn DA, between the chief of police, between young people, and between the Department of Education. So I think these links, I think, were really started to intrigue me. I also think that the nature of the Pakistani community, I thought that I would see one monolithic community making that sort of assumption that a lot of people probably do. But instead I saw Nepalese and Indians, and I saw mixtures and mishmash, hodgepodge of relationships with the Hasidic community, Hasidic Jewish community, with the Caribbean and Russian populations. So it was really eye-opening experience.
That's interesting how people make affiliations and relationships and form bonds living in communities. I think that's a fascinating topic. I do want to ask you a little bit, and it's probably an unfair extrapolation, or maybe you have an intuition about this. Are some of the ideas that you're using to help youth at SIA, are they translatable to some of the youth issues that I know you've lived in South Asia and lived there enough to understand the community somewhat and situation on the ground? Are any of these ideas are you able to translate them to at-risk youth in Pakistan or India or Bangladesh? Do you see some connections?
Yeah, I do see the connections. Maybe they're not so strong now because I still have some ways to go in my education, in my degree. But the connections I'm seeing is, one is inequality. So in Pakistan, there's a number of factors that keep the haves and have-nots apart. And in Brooklyn and New York City, of course, we have the same inequality, but a different nature of inequality. So what holds the working class and the middle class and upper class apart may be a little bit different from what's happening in South Asia. But that's one thing. One common trend I saw, and the other thing I saw, of course, is in the United States we have this what people call the cultural gap or the generation gap. I think that's more. It takes a different shape here in New York City. In Pakistan, maybe it's the young generation, the generation X or Y, maybe are more familiar with the internet, are more likely to go online or to have more, you can say, cosmopolitan ideas. While in the United States, here in New York City, there's a divide not just around the internet or around youth, but also a divide around the inculcation of American political ideas and American social ideas that sometimes causes a bit of friction between, you know, father and son, mother and daughter, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Muntasir, that I was thinking about this question because I think the theme has come up a couple times in the conversation. You know, I think that there's an imperfect balance we're all struggling with as the world gets a lot smaller between diversity and unity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a lot of ways the U.S. has done reasonably good job in terms of striking a good balance. How did these young people see the larger culture? How do they see each other? And how is that balance in these young people that work at SIA and in the greater New York area from South Asia, how is it informed by unity and diversity?
Oh, wow. You sound like my professor. Well, I can just tell you what I'm seeing. And I'm seeing that young people here in New York City, I'm more familiar with America than with anywhere else, but what I'm seeing here is high school students and college students, their aspirations are probably a little bit different from their families. And perhaps while back home, their parents might have more strong linkages with kinship or with caste or with religion, young people here have more choices, and they sometimes see themselves as Hindu or Parsi or Christian or whatever. But you know, they also see themselves as New Yorkers. One young person, put it this way: I may not fight for America. I'm not sure if I'm you know, strong enough or if I'm tough enough to fight in an army for the United States. But I know for sure if something were to happen to New York, I would definitely stand and defend my city and my state. So you have these different loyalties and different ideas of self, and the old idea of the nation and the state as homogenous, the idea of the melting pot is kind of a homogenous idea. And actually, what's happening is we're having a little more diversity than the Enlightenment thinkers expected or anticipated. So what I'm saying is while you have young Punjabi, young Sikh youth who see themselves as Punjabi but not Indian, and you might have a Pakistani who sees himself as American but not necessarily South Asian but Pakistani, you know, or you might see a Bangladeshi who sees himself as Muslim but not Asian or an immigrant. So you have these interesting things, and I think that theoretically and, you know, culturally and socially, we're not ready to quite understand what is happening. We're having this really cool and interesting hodgepodge in terms of intermarriages and business partnerships and all kinds of things. So I think it's just going to give birth to more and more heterogeneity and maybe change our ideas of what a melting pot is.
Wow, Muntasir, that's really, it's so many chords with me. And, you know, I think that's one of the things Bill and I are after, to explore this hodgepodge of identities. especially in South, all over the world, but especially in South Asia. Would you agree, Bill, that's something that really we're intensely curious about?
Yeah, I think somehow or other we've got to figure out how to merge the word hodgepodge into everything we do here.
That's right.
Yeah,
melting pot is so 20th century.
Yeah, the hodgepodge is the theme to go for.
You heard it here first.
That's right. You heard it here first. On that note, Muntasir, thanks so much for joining us this evening. I know you're busy with your thesis work, taking time off. You're at your university right now in between your research sessions, so I really appreciate the time and also the inspiration. What we do, what Bill and I do, a lot of it is around introducing ideas and perspectives and a lens through which the South Asian North American community has not been seen through before, and you've really helped us do that today.
No problem. My pleasure.
Thanks, Muntasir.
Thanks, Muntasir.
All right. Good night.
Take care.
To learn more about the good work being done through South Asian Youth Action, please visit them on the web at www.saya.org.